Thank you, Billy. Hi, everybody. My name is Jack, and I am an alcoholic. And I want to thank the Blue Ridge Group for inviting me to be here this evening. It's a bit of a drive from Hagerstown to here, but it's well worth it. My friend Brad is with me, and we had a great meeting in the car coming down. We had a nice period of fellowship with some folks who are responsible for the meeting, and I anticipate on the way back we'll probably listen to a speaker tape or two. And I am a member of the Hagerstown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, cleverly named. Nobody really knew this thing was going to catch on, so when a meeting opened up in a town, you just named it Frederick Group, Hagerstown Group. We got 15 meetings now in Hagerstown, and 15 different groups and maybe 55, 60 meetings a week. Who knew a coffee pot and a resentment could go so far? But it's Billy's correct. I do have a sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor people. I've got a home group, and I'm currently privileged to be the GSR of our home group, and I think service is an important part of recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I encourage anybody who's contemplating service to take action on that thought. I thank Billy. Actually, I thank the group for letting Billy invite me to be here, and I think it's important that you know that Billy is responsible for my being here, and that's because if I say anything here this evening that you approve of or you like, well, please give me the credit and give me an attaboy at the end of the meeting. But as frequently happens, I may say something that causes you to have a resentment or might anger you. And if that is your experience, well, please talk to Billy about that. He's the one that's responsible for me being here. I'm going to put my watch up here, not because I really see it or pay much attention to it, but I think it gives hope to the newcomer, and I know there's some folks here are new, and you know, if I run over the 2.5 hours Billy said that I've been allotted, I know somebody will, you know, say something about that. My book tells me that I am to tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now, and I'll try to do that. You need to know that I am not a spokesperson for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not an authority on Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm somebody who's been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and before a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was an attender of Alcoholics Anonymous, as you'll hear shortly. If you have a cell phone with you here tonight, by all means, please turn it on if you're expecting a liver transplant. But if not, then put it on vibrate, and that way you can enjoy your incoming call and you won't disturb the rest of us. Now, I need to tell you that my dad was an alcoholic. So I've known what alcoholics were for a good part of my life. He's in the big book. He was a real alcoholic. And this I'm going to tell you about an event that happened when I was about 14 years old that had a significant impact on my life. My sister and my mom were out shopping. My sister was about 11, I think, at the time, and I was 14. And Dad and I were home, and he was trying to get me to do something that I didn't want to do. And so he was trying to negotiate with me to make a deal. And he said, son, he said, I'll do anything that you want me to do if you'll do this thing for me. And I said, all right, I'll make that deal. He said, well, what do you want me to do, son? And I said, I want you to stop drinking. Well, he thought a little bit, and he said, well, he said, I know your mother wants me to stop drinking, and he said, I know it's been causing some trouble here at home and at the store, and
Okay.
I'll stop drinking. I'm telling you, I was ecstatic. I mean, this was a result of prayer. I have been praying that my dad would stop drinking. And when my mom and my sister got home that night, I met them at the door. And I told them, our problems are over. Dad and I have had a talk, and he's agreed to stop drinking. And joy reigned supreme in our house that night. I thought, man, there is a God. God is good. This is wonderful. And the next day, my dad got drunk. And that's the day I closed the door on God. Because while I believed that there was a God, I didn't want to have anything to do with a God who would play fast and loose like that with the prayers of a young boy, the prayers of my mother. Obviously, there's something wrong with me. I'm deficient. My prayers are not worthy. The God that I believed in obviously didn't want to have anything to do with me. And if I'm going to do anything or make anything out of myself in this life, then I'm going to do it on my own, by myself. And so I set out. Now, wasn't too long after that, I got introduced to alcohol. And my guess is that alcohol did for me probably pretty much the same thing it did for you. It was the solution to all my problems, really. It allowed me to do things that I could never have done without drinking. And go to dances. Talk to people. Actually have conversations. Talk to girls. You know, dance. I thought when I was drinking that I could sing. It was the elixir of life. I felt sorry for my dad because he was having a hard go of it, couldn't handle it. But I was doing okay. Now when you're 15, 16, 17 years old, you can't drink as much as you'd like to. But I drank as often as I could. And I tried to do that as much as I could. And I heard a lady one time say when she started drinking that her pimples fell off and her boobs got big. Well, my pimples didn't. My pimples did fall off, but I didn't have the boob experience. But alcohol became, for me, unknowing. I mean, I never saw this till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, but alcohol became, for me, the driving force in my life. Now, in trying to think, I'd like to tell you that alcohol didn't cause me any trouble when I was in high school, but I spent 5 years in high school. And I'm afraid that drinking had a lot to do with that. And then when I got out of high school, I went to the community college, and I guess it was at the end of my second year in the community college, my good friend and I had decided that we were going to go to California. And I quit my summer job, We're going to leave the 1st of August. Each of us had an overnight bag, and we got 12 cases of beer, loaded them all in my car, and we were getting ready to leave, and we had everything you need for a trip cross country, and then his father wouldn't let him go. The night before we were to leave, said, "You can't go." Now, what am I going to do? You know, I got a pocket full of money, I mean, I got some money, and I got no job, and a car with 12 cases of beer. Well, as many of you know, there on the eastern border of Maryland, there is a town called Ocean City. And that's where a lot of folks go in the summertime, and so that's where I went. And I had friends who were working there, and they allowed me to sleep in the basement of hotels for free, and they allowed me to go to restaurants and eat leftover food at night. I'd have half a lobster tail or a crab cake or... You know, I didn't have to pay for any place to stay, and I didn't have to pay for any food. And I got that 12 cases of beer, and then when that ran out, you know, I had money to to spend on other beer. Now, during the month that I was in Ocean City, I liked what I saw in Ocean City. I liked the lifestyle. I liked the summer. I liked the partying. I liked all of it. But there was one thing that kind of disturbed me, and that was, if you drank like I drank and acted like I acted, it didn't make any difference if you were a beach boy or a lifeguard or a waiter or a waitress or a bartender. I mean, it just didn't make any difference. They'd arrest you. And observing the social scene in Ocean City, I became aware of the fact that there was one group of people who were not getting arrested, and they were the police. So the next year, I became a policeman in Ocean City, Maryland. And the first year I was a policeman there, I had a boardwalk beat. And I had not been walking my beat more than a couple of days. And it became apparent that I have a talent that is unique. And that is, I can spot an underage drinker from about 100 yards. And I'd identify this underage drinker, and I would approach him, and we'd have a conversation. We would establish that they were indeed underage, and I would ask to look in the cooler. And, of course, you open the cooler, and there's a Coca-Cola laid out, nice, even rows, little tuna fish in the corner. But you know as well as I do, when you reach down in the bottom of that cooler, and you get all the way down to the bottom, and you come up with the Budweiser. And that's when the conversation would change. Because you see, their life had just ended as they knew it. You're thinking about going to college? You're going to jail. You're not going to college. Think about going to the military? Not happening for you, bud. You're going to go down to the jail, and you're going to have to call your parents and get them to drive down here from Baltimore or Frederick or wherever the hell you live to get you out. Your life is over. Now, most of these people were pretty clever. And then they'd say something like, couldn't we find some alternative to this? What do you have in mind? Well, couldn't you take the beer? Take the beer? Well, if I take the beer, I'm going to have to take the cooler. If I take the cooler, I'm going to have to take the Coke and the tuna fish. That's okay. Well, if it's okay with you, it's okay by me, but don't let me catch you again. Now, it's hard to walk a beat when you're dragging a cooler full of beer around behind you. So I worked out this deal with my sergeant and my lieutenant that they would come and get the beer in their cruiser, and they'd take it. And at the end of the shift, if I happen to come up with any whiskey or wine, I give that to them. I keep the beer. And I had a good summer. I didn't buy anything to drink that summer, and I didn't get arrested. And that's my definition of a good summer. Well, the second year I went back, they gave me a squad car. Now, you can do a lot with a squad car, believe me. First of all, you got a big trunk, so you don't have to be calling your lieutenant and sergeant. But when I would go off the air, they knew that something was up. So whenever I came in at the end of a shift, they would meet me and just take the whiskey and the wine, and I'd keep the beer. And now I'm going to tell you about an event that occurred. I didn't get arrested, by the way, that summer, and I didn't buy anything to drink. So I had another good summer. And with that kind of luck, you want to go back for a third summer. And here's what happened the third summer. This is one of those benchmarks that turns the course of your life. 3 o'clock in the morning, I stopped a guy for drunk driving on the beach highway. I'm writing him the ticket. You know, I don't recognize his name as being anybody. And he says, you don't know who I am, do you, officer? I said, no, I don't. He said, I am the state's attorney for Worcester County, the county you're standing in right now. Well, I was a college kid. I didn't know what a state's attorney was. So I said, well, good for you. Sign the ticket. He signed the ticket, and there was a guy in the car that didn't appear to be drunk, so I let him drive. And they went on their way. And I, into my shift, 8 o'clock, pulled into the parking lot of the police headquarters. And there was the chief of police. He said, "Quarterman, come up to my office and bring that uniform citation book with you." Now, these were the first words that the chief had spoken to me all year. And I thought this was a good thing. I thought I was going to be getting recognition. Long overdue recognition, I might add, for a job well done. So I went up to the office, and I walked in, and lo and behold, right inside the door, sitting on the couch, was the guy I gave the ticket to at 3 o'clock in the morning. And the chief said, "Give me that citation book." So I gave it to him. He flips it open to the ticket. He hands it to the guy on the couch. That guy takes out a pen, and he writes across the face of that ticket, "Case dismissed." It was at that moment I decided I wanted to be a lawyer. And if I could become one of those state's attorneys, the power to dismiss traffic charges with the stroke of a pen was going to come in real handy because of the way I drank and drove. So I went to law school. Law school interfered with my drinking. There are a lot of smart people in law school. I wasn't one of them. So my drinking was kind of trimmed down to weekends. And my wife and I had met in college. We got married. I graduated law school. Went back to my hometown, Hagerstown. Hadn't been there very long, and I noticed that there was a vacancy in the state's attorney's office for an assistant state's attorney. So I marched right over there. I said, "Here I am." Now, what I'm about to tell you is what I heard them say. Now, this is important because there's something wrong with my hearing. I don't hear things always the way they happen or the way they're said. Now, this is what I think I heard. "What? You want a job here? You have no experience. You've never tried a case. You've never interviewed a witness. You've never been in a courtroom. You don't know anything. Get out of the office." That's what I think I heard him say. In truth, upon reflection, I think he said something like, "The position has already been filled." But I know what I thought I heard, and it angered me. I now know, having been in AA, that I had a resentment. And you know what an alcoholic can do with a good resentment. So I assume that you all down here, like we do, elect your prosecutors. And I went out and found a lawyer who wanted to be state's attorney. I ran his campaign for state's attorney. He got elected state's attorney, and he made me deputy state's attorney. It's a good deal to me, till I discovered that we didn't have any badges. There's no point in being a state's attorney if you don't have a badge. You've got to have a badge. So I designed a really nice badge. And when you get a badge, you get a badge case. And you put your badge in there, and then they have a glassine place where you put your driver's license. So when you get stopped by the police and they ask to see your license, you open up that badge case. They don't look at the license. They want to know, what kind of badge is that? Deputy State's Attorney, Washington County. "Officer, no problem. No, sir, I'm not offended. No, sir, I understand you're only doing your job." "Certainly, I'll slow it down. I only got a couple miles to go." "No problem." "Thank you. You have a nice evening, officer." Now, you may be getting some idea as to why I've never been arrested and I don't have any DWIs in my background. But my boss, who was the state's attorney, was supposed to be appointed circuit court judge. And this was going to be a good thing, because if he got to be circuit court judge, then I'd get to be state's attorney. But as so often happens in these things, in our case, the local state senator stuck his nose in, got it all messed up, and somebody else got appointed judge. And I was I was upset. I was offended. I was angered. Not because my friend didn't get to be judge. Oh, I felt bad about that, but what really upset me is I didn't get to be state's attorney. I had a resentment over that. One night, a bunch of us who drank like I drank, we were all sitting around talking about what to do about this situation, and we decided that somebody needed to teach that state senator a lesson. Somebody ought to run against him. Now, he was the majority leader of the Senate. He was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee. He had been elected 4 terms. But somebody ought to show him. So I ran for the state senate. Now, I didn't know he was going to abandon his wife and children and run off with the secretary to the Appropriations Committee, but he did. And I got elected state senator. Now, I don't know about here in Virginia, but when you get elected state senator in Maryland, they give you a license plate. And it says, State Senator. This is an aid to efficient law enforcement. Because when they come up behind you on the interstate, and they got those lights on, and they get close enough to see that license plate, they turn those overheads off. They pull up alongside, they turn that interior dome light on, and they beep the horn. Hi, Senator. Hi, Officer. Hold it down, Senator. Okay, Officer. And this way, you don't have policemen tied up alongside of the road when they could be out fighting real crime. Now, I told you about that guy got appointed judge. He didn't like the job. So he resigned. And I went to the governor, and I said, Governor, I'd like you to appoint my friend, the state's attorney, judge. And the governor said, not doing it. I'm still upset about all the adverse publicity that was generated about that appointment back 6 years ago. So I'm not going to appoint your guy, judge. But if you'd like to be judge, I'll appoint you. Well, it's a 15-year term, and it only comes around every now and then, so I thought, why not? So I got appointed circuit court judge. And at the time, I was the youngest circuit court judge in the state of Maryland. Now, keep in mind, all along all of this, I'm drinking alcoholically. I'm drinking just about every day. There are some days where I've sworn off forever. There were other days that... I think maybe this is getting to be a problem. I'm going to stop for a month. Stop for a month. And then along about Friday of the second week, I've worked really hard. A drink would taste real good right about now. I've earned a drink. Yeah, but Jack, you said you're not going to drink for a month. Well, I haven't had anything to drink for 12 days. And everybody knows if you can go 12 days without drinking, you can go a month without drinking. Yeah, Jack, but you said you weren't going to drink for 30 days. Yeah, but I am really thirsty. And who made up this rule anyway? Well, Jack, you did. Well, then if I made it up, I can make a new rule. I'm not drinking for 12 days. And then I'd go have a drink. I found out that it's easy to quit drinking. I think all of you know that. It's real easy to quit drinking. The problem for me, and maybe the problem for you, is what happens after I quit drinking. Because then I'm just thinking. I'm just thinking. And sooner or later, I'm back to drinking. And that was my experience. One night, the Bar Association was having an education program on the prosecution and defense of drunk driving. And Sergeant Long was going to be there with his breathalyzer, and they needed somebody to drink the beer and blow into the breathalyzer. Somebody who was unbiased, fair, okay, I'll volunteer, I'll help you out. And, the guy at the hotel, he brought out 6 cans of beer, all iced down in this tray. I said, what's that? He said, "That's the beer for tonight's program." I said, "You do realize this is a two-hour program, and you only brought six beers." "Oh," he says, "I got more in the back." I said, "Well, you've got to bring them out now, because I'm not drinking any warm beer." And so he did. He went and got another tray full of beer. And the deal was, they warmed the breathalyzer up, and the program started, and I started drinking, and 15 minutes into the thing, I blow into the breathalyzer, and, 0.08, and then they go another 15 minutes, and I blow into the breathalyzer, and I'm drinking, and, 0.13, and, a little longer than 0.15, and 0.18, and 0.21, and we got up there at 0.23, and then 0.27, and 0.29, we had a 0.30 and a 0.32, and then they called upon me to put on my part of the program, which I'm told was pretty good under the circumstances. After the program was over and they were packing up to leave, I said to the guy who was the host of the program, I said, "Who's driving me home?" He went, "What do you mean?" I said, "Well, I just blew a 0.33 in Sergeant Long's breathalyzer. I can't go out and get in the car." He said, "Well, we hadn't thought about that." I said, "Well, I'll tell you what." I said, "I'm going in the bar. And when Sergeant Long leaves, you let me know." So I went into the bar, and I had a couple drinks, and they came in and said Sergeant Long was gone. So I went down to the Broad Axe, and I had a couple drinks. And then I went over to the cellar door, and I had a couple drinks. And then I went home. And that was just another night of social drinking for the judge. And April 7th, 1982, a lawyer and I were going out to, we said we were going out to dinner, but we were real going out to just see how much we could drink. And we did good. We did real good. And we ended up at a local cocktail lounge, which was frequented by most of the single, recently separated or divorced women in our community. We went in there just to have a nightcap. And had I known that this was going to be my last drink, had I known that I was going to have to come here to Madison, Virginia, and talk to you about my last drink, if I'd have known that was going to be important, I assure you I would have ordered something else. I had a love affair with Jack Daniel's Black on the Rocks with a Twist. Oh man, that was to die for. Oh, that was just. Now I liked. I was very fond of the gin martini. Very fond of the gin martini, but I had a really bad gin experience. And to this day, it's hard for me to go into a pine forest. I mean, it just affects me. I liked everything about drinking. I liked top shelf whiskey. I liked bottom shelf whiskey. I liked everything about it. But if you were to thrust a paper bag to me and said, "Take a pull on this," I'd take a pull on it, and I wouldn't ask you what was in it. Because you've already vouched for it. You said, "Here, have some of this." Well, you wouldn't offer it to me if it wasn't good. So I, oh, boy. Whoo, that's good. Man, a daisy. You know how sometimes y'all have people over to the house to play poker or party or whatever, and you're cleaning up the next morning, and there's cans sitting around, and you're cleaning up, and hey, this one's about half full. What was that? Cigarette butt. Yeah, I know. I see some heads nodding. There's cigarette butt drinkers in here for sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that night, April 7th, 1982, I'm embarrassed to tell you, but I will tell you, I had a Tia Maria. Yeah, I know. Yeah. You feel sorry for me too, don't you? Yeah. I don't know why. I really don't. I don't know why. And there's others in here saying, "What the hell's that?" And I said, "I wish I could tell you. I can't. All I know is that was it. It did, however, come out of a tainted bottle. And the reason I know it was a tainted bottle is because I threw up on the way home. It had to be that last drink of Tia Maria. Had to be. I have a high tolerance for alcohol. Well, I might throw up sometimes if I've had greasy food or something, but and besides, throwing up is part of drinking. I understand that, but not on the way home when you're done drinking. So it had to be a tainted bottle. Had to be. Now, my wife's a school teacher, teaches elementary school. Those little children, they bring every disease in the community into the classroom. And then my wife brings it home. Yeah. Disease-infested little children. And I got up the next morning, I got flu. She's brought flu home. And I got it. Well, I went to work, and because that's what we did. We go to work if we can get there. And after, that was a Thursday. Friday was Good Friday. Court was closed. I got the flu. I've got the upset stomach that comes with flu. Yeah, upset stomach comes with flu. Saturday, I started developing that lower tract distress that comes with flu, but I still got the upset stomach thing. Now, if you got upset stomach and lower tract distress, that'll hone your decision-making down to a fine edge because you don't know whether to kneel or sit or sit or kneel. And sometime during that process, my wife will tell you, I made the wrong decision. And if she were here, you could talk to her about that. But I'm going to keep on. Now, Easter Sunday, I still had the same thing. And on Monday, they put me in the hospital. Because of all that kneeling and sitting I'd been doing, I was dehydrated. And, well, that night, my abdomen became distended. They did an emergency laparotomy on me and opened me up, and they found my abdomen full of peritonitis, gangrene. And trying to clean that up, and my kidneys quit. My liver was enlarged, and my pancreas was digesting itself, and my respiratory system quit. So things weren't looking good for the home team. And Hagerstown is a small town, has a newspaper, and I'm the youngest judge in the state, so you know, judge in the hospital with flu, news item. And a week after that, it was like, judge's condition worsens. And then judge placed on critical list. And it was real clear I was becoming a public relations nightmare for the Hagerstown Hospital. And so they came in to me and they said, I was in intensive care 3 weeks. And they came in and told me that they were going to send me to Johns Hopkins. And I thought, this is good news. Because I knew people who'd gone to Johns Hopkins and they'd come home. And I knew people who'd gone to the Washington County Hospital and they had died. So I was encouraged. My wife, on the other hand, they told her they were sending me to Johns Hopkins to die. Because my condition was deteriorating. They didn't know what to do for me. But maybe Hopkins could help. And so I went to Hopkins, and they did, and 2 weeks, first 2 weeks I was there, they did just about everything but hang me by my thumbs. And my belly button birthday is on May 14th. So on May 13th, these doctors came in to see me. I was off the respirator. I was able to breathe on my own. Kidneys still weren't working. Liver still enlarged. Pancreas digesting itself. And I couldn't take anymore. I just couldn't take it anymore. And so when these learned physicians came in to see me that night, before they could utter a word, I told them, I said, I just can't take it anymore. Yeah, tomorrow is my birthday. Please, please give me a day of rest. Let me just rest. They said, well, Judge, I mean, that's what we came in here to tell you. We have presented your case to the internal medicine department here at Hopkins. We can't get a majority vote on what's wrong with you. We don't know what's wrong with you. We've done everything we know to do, and that's why we're here. We're here to tell you that we're not going to do any more. Yeah, you can have your day of rest. So I turned 40 in the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And 2 weeks later, May 28th, I walked out of that hospital. My kidney function returned. My liver started to reduce in size. My pancreas stopped digesting itself. When you're in a hospital for an extended stay like that, the doctors want to talk to you before they let you out. And it's usually to tell you what to do or not do so that you don't get what you had. But in my case, they didn't know what I had, so they didn't know what to tell me. They just told me that they suggested I not get it again because it might kill me. I maintained then, and I still maintain, I think it's much better to survive an undiagnosed illness than to die of a known cause. I believed that then, and I believe that now. But as I was getting up to walk out of that doctor's office, they said to me, "Whoa, Judge, just a moment. One more question. Do you drink?" "Yeah, what kind of question is that?" "Well, yeah, I drink. I'm a lawyer." Well, I was a lawyer. I had to drink with clients. I had to drink with other lawyers. I had to drink with judges. Now I'm a judge. I got to drink with lawyers. I got to drink with judges. Sure I drink. "Why?" "Well, how much do you drink?" "Oh, I don't drink much at all." "No. But why do you ask?" "Well, you know, alcohol does a real number on your kidneys, and your kidney functions just return, and we think maybe you ought to just take some time off from drinking. Not to mention your liver, your enzyme levels are coming back into balance, and your liver is reducing in size, and alcohol does a number on your liver. Then, of course, there's your pancreas. I mean, alcohol just knocks the bejesus out of your pancreas, and you got all three of these vital organs involved. We just think you should not drink." Well, haven't had anything to drink since April the 7th. This is May 28th. I think I can do that. All right, I'll do that. They said, "No, Judge, you don't understand. This is Memorial Day weekend, and we want you to not drink from June the 1st. June the 1st? Well, I suspect that there are probably people in this room already who have been able to discern the injustice that they were trying to perpetuate upon me, because I wasn't getting any credit for my 7 weeks of sobriety. And I want you to know I fought for those 7 weeks. And an argument ensued between me, the knucklehead judge, and these two learned doctors. And we arrived at a compromise, and that was I would not drink until April 7th of the next year. And then, if I thought that drinking had anything to do with the pain and suffering that I had endured for the past 7 weeks, I would not drink till June 1st. And then if I wanted to drink, I could drink. Okay. I need to tell you that when I talk to people about that fighting for those 7 weeks of sobriety, most people that I talk to, normal people, don't laugh at that. You know, they look at me like I'm crazy. And of course, I am crazy. I am crazy. Which, of course, calls into question your sanity. Because you're sitting in here listening to me. But I digress. Walked out of Johns Hopkins Hospital May 28th, never to drink again. And I embarked upon the most insane period of my life. Absolutely had no idea what was going on, except I was not drinking. And I did the not drinking thing. It's like going on the wagon, swearing off forever. It's kind of like not drinking and going to meetings. You know, I don't know here in Madison if you tell people that, but I sure hope you don't. Because don't drink and don't go to meetings kills people. Kills people. What works is don't drink, go to meetings, get a sponsor, take the steps, get a service position, help others. Now that works. Trust God, clean house. That works. But don't drink, go to meetings. That just means I'm dry, 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 and I'm absolutely insane, and you have taken my medicine from me. And I don't know how to live. I don't know how to live. Two friends, Bob and Ken, both active members of Alcoholics Anonymous in our community, could see that I was dying of untreated alcoholism. Dying. Should tell you that when I was drinking, when I was actively drinking, my wife and I were separated three times, and there were women involved. And after I stopped drinking, my wife and I were separated three times, and there were women involved. Now, I think that's a pretty clear indication that drinking had nothing to do with those separations. But alcoholism had everything to do with those separations. Because nothing had changed. Nothing had changed other than I wasn't drinking. Well, if I don't screw this thing up, my wife and I will be married 40 years come August. Well, she's been married 40 years, and as you've heard, I've had lapses in between. But the fact remains that you don't have to be divorced to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't have to be. Ken and Bob saw that I was dying of untreated alcoholism, and my dad, my alcoholic dad, on July the 3rd of 1968, he walked by the Methodist Church in Hagerstown, and the pastor put out on the board, "Don't buy a fifth on the third for the fourth." He went to AA that night, and he never drank again. He died with 15 years of continuous sobriety in this wonderful program. And I owe a tremendous debt of gratitude to Alcoholics Anonymous, if for nothing else but that. His life was restored to him. I mean, he'd lost everything of value. He lost his marriage to my mom of 30 years. He lost the respect of my sister and myself. When my sister got married, she wouldn't even invite our father to the wedding because she was afraid he would come drunk. He certainly wouldn't be invited to give her away. I gave her away. And he came to the wedding, and he came drunk. He lost his business. We lost the house. But more importantly, he lost his self-respect. You know. Came to AA. Got it all back. I mean, the stuff that you can't buy. He had a wonderful marriage to my stepmother. He got his self-respect back. He became a man of integrity. You could rely upon him. He helped a lot of people and died with 15 years in this program. Now, Bob did not know my dad, but he knew he died with 15 years in AA, and so Bob suggested, he was talking to me one day, and he said, "You know, maybe Jack, you'd like to read something about your father's illness. Find out about this thing, this disease that he had." "Well, what did you have in mind, Bob?" He says, "Well, we have this book in Alcoholics Anonymous called Alcoholics Anonymous. And it tells all about alcoholism. You ought to read it. You'd find out about your dad's disease." Clever guy, that Bob. I mean, he knew I'm dying of untreated alcoholism. I think you know and I know if he'd have said, "Jack, read this book, find out what's wrong with you." I ain't not doing that, because there's nothing wrong with me. Nothing wrong with me. I'll admit, okay, the wife and I are separated yet again, yes, and I have a girlfriend, and I've got a backup girlfriend, and I've got a special girlfriend for special occasions, but I'm handling that just fine, Bob. I don't have a relationship problem. Now, if you're looking for a delusional thought, that's one of them. That's a delusional thought. And the book says we're driven by 100 forms of self-delusion. I cannot differentiate the true from the false. I cannot differentiate the true from the false. I tell myself lies. I believe them to be true. I take action, and I suffer the consequences. And a lot of other people suffer the consequences. So Bob gave me a copy of the big book, and I read it. My dad's in there. Not surprised he's in there. He's a real alcoholic. I told you that. Much to my surprise, it would appear that I'm in there. You know, there's a part in the big book where it says, many of us at an early age closed the door on God. Told you about that thing when I was 14. I thought I was the only one. And here in this book it says, many of us have done that. And in Bill's story, it talks about how he goes into the bar, he's not going to drink, absolutely not going to drink, and then whiskey rising to his head after the sixth drink, he's pounding on the bar. How did this ever happen to me? I go into the Broad Axe where I did most of my drinking. I said, I'm just going to have one, no more than two. You know? Never. Never. You know, I'll be home by six, no later than seven. Next thing I know, it's 8 o'clock. I'm pounding on the bar. How did this happen to me? Man, how do they know that? How do they know that stuff? So Ken and Bob, they started coming to my chambers every Friday afternoon at lunchtime. Every Friday at lunchtime, they bring their big books, a brown paper, a brown bag lunch, and we would read the big book, and then they would tell me about what we'd read, and I would tell them what I thought we'd read. And you can imagine, we had some very interesting conversations. Ken and Bob were real insistent on me going to meetings, and as circuit court judge, I personally was responsible for tremendous growth in attendance at Alcoholics Anonymous, because I know what to do with alcoholics when I see them. And I sent them to Alcoholics Anonymous in droves. So AA had a big attendance spike in Hagerstown when I was judging. And I'm not going to meetings with those people. That ain't happening. So I did go up Interstate 81 to Chambersburg and go to meetings up there. And I came down 81 to Martinsburg and went to some meetings there. And I went over Interstate 70 to Frederick and went to some meetings there. And I would, you know, I would get there, and most of the meetings started with a serenity prayer, and at the end, then they would do this Lord's Prayer thing. And I only got caught at that maybe once or twice, and then I got to where I could figure out where the meeting's winding down, and I could leave the meeting before the prayer. But as you, most of you probably know, not all meetings start on time. So I would come late, and I still get stuck with a serenity prayer, you know. Because if you noticed in this book, there's a lot of God stuff in here. And I got nothing to do with God. I'll explain to you why. So, it was Friday, it was December the 22nd of 1989, and we couldn't have our big book study on Friday because the courthouse was closed 3 days before Christmas. Christmas was on Monday that year. And so we went out to lunch, three of us. And after lunch, I went back to my apartment. Propped against the door of my apartment was a Hickory Farms cheese log box. See those things a lot at Christmas. Thought this was nice. Somebody sent the judge a sausage. Went up to my apartment and went into the apartment and trying to figure out how to open this box. And sealed with tape, and I finally found the tape, and I was listening to answers on my answering machine. I slipped the tape with my car key, and I lifted the lid, and boom! And I got blown back against the wall. And a federal judge had been killed in Birmingham, Alabama, about 10 days before that by a package bomb that had been sent to his house. And a lawyer in Savannah had been killed about 5 days before that by a bomb that had been sent to his office. And I could smell the gunpowder, and I knew that I had opened a bomb. And there was a fire, and I couldn't put it out. So I went out and hooked the fire alarm and came back, and my neighbor came with a fire extinguisher. And I went to call 911, and when I went to dial the number or punch the buttons on the phone, I realized that part of my right hand had been blown away, and when I hung the phone up, it felt like somebody was trying to pull the trousers off my hips. And I looked down, and I was standing in a puddle of blood, and it was just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And I knew I was in serious trouble, and my neighbor asked if there was anything else he could do for me, and I asked, well, could you get me a towel? And I opened my trousers, and I didn't have the courage to try to visualize where the wound was. I just put the towel where I thought I'd been injured, and put my back against the wall, and slid down on the floor. It was real clear to me that I was dying. And I was going to die on that floor. I was never going to see my wife or never going to see our children again. And I didn't know what to do. Scared, real scared. And the only thing that I had learned in that time that I had been attending Alcoholics Anonymous is I had learned serenity prayer. So I began to ask God to grant me the serenity to accept this thing which I couldn't change. The courage to change what I could, and wisdom to know the difference. And I prayed that prayer, 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 and somewhere, I don't know, sixth, seventh, eighth time through that prayer, it was answered. And God came. And I was overcome by a sense of peace and well-being that I had never experienced before and haven't experienced since. I didn't know if I was going to live or die. What I knew was that I was, whatever happened, it was going to be okay. If I died on that floor that afternoon and never saw my wife and children again, it would be okay. It would be okay. And if I survive this thing, it'll be okay. Be okay. Police and emergency medical people, when the firemen came bursting in the apartment, and both of my eardrums had been blown out, and they were talking and yelling to me, and I couldn't understand what they were saying. And as soon as I stopped praying the serenity prayer, this tremendous wave of fear swept upon me. And so I told them, I said, you guys do whatever you have to do, and I'm going back to doing what I was doing. And I went back to the serenity prayer, and as soon as I started praying it, serenity came back. They cut all my clothes off of me, and they put me on a gurney or on a board and carried me down, put me on a gurney and stuffed me in the ambulance, took me to the hospital, and they were preparing me for surgery. And they couldn't find my wife, and they did find how they found Ken, my sponsor. And they let him come back to where I was being prepared for surgery. And Ken came and he held my hand, and he prayed with me, and he stayed with me till they took me up to surgery. And I don't know how shrapnel knows to stop passing through flesh. All I can tell you is that they removed a piece of shrapnel, not resting against, but in close proximity to my femoral artery. And I think we all know that if my femoral artery had been nicked, you'd have a different speaker here tonight, that's for sure. And they sewed me up, and they took me up to a recovery room, and I guess it was maybe the second day there, and my sponsor, Bob, came. And he was seated at the foot of my bed, and I saw he was smiling. And I said, you know, I say here, it's good to have a sponsor. Really is. It's good to have a sponsor because sponsors have a whole different take on things. And Bob was smiling, and I said, Bob, I see you're smiling. What are you smiling about? He said, oh, nah, not much, Jack. He said, I just think it must be wonderful. I said, wonderful, Bob? I'm not following you. But what's wonderful? He said, I just think it must be wonderful to know that you can't be harmed. I said, Bob, somebody just tried to kill me. Maybe you can explain yourself. He said, well, Jack, he says, I understand that there were four pipe bombs in that package that you opened. One pipe bomb is more than adequate to kill a human being. Two pipe bombs is a little redundant. Three pipe bombs around the bend. Four pipe bombs, Jack? You have really made somebody very angry. But I would say that man has done his very best to kill you. And you're here by the grace of God. And I said, it's good to have a sponsor. But I wouldn't have come up with that in a million years. I never would have come up with that. He said, God has work for you, Jack. You've been spared. I said, what kind of work, Bob, have I been spared to do? He said, I haven't got the slightest idea, Jack. He said, but I do know that it's God's will for you to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And to do that, you're going to have to stop being an attender of Alcoholics Anonymous and become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And you're going to have to pray that third step prayer with me or with Kent. You're going to have to do that fourth step inventory. You're going to have to do that fifth step with me or with Kent. You're going to have to do six and seven, make that eight-step list. You're going to have to do those nine-step amends so you can live successfully in 10, 11, and 12 and be of service to God and to your fellow men. Good to have a sponsor. I wouldn't have come up with that one either. I had what I like to call a cake mix recovery at that point. If we would go out here to the local grocery store and were to get a box of that red velvet cake mix that Duncan Hines makes, I can assure you on the back of that package, they have a three-step program to produce a red velvet cake. And I'm the kind of guy that I get that box of cake mix and I read that three-step program on the back of that box and I start looking around for my cake. You see, that's what I was doing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was reading the book, reading the steps, and I'm looking around for recovery. And if I want red velvet cake, I got to take action on that cake mix. I got to open that box, and I got to get into action. And if I want to have recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous, then I got to take action on these steps. I had cake mix recovery. Simple as that. And Bob and Ken, God bless them. They took me through the steps, and kicking and screaming all the way. I did mention to you how that about the God thing. I'm not doing the God thing, all right? And Bob said, how old were you when your dad and you had that agreement? I said, I was 14. And you've been praying that your dad would stop drinking? I said, yes, I had been. How old were you when your dad stopped drinking? I was 26. Bob said, do you have any idea, Jack, what 12 years means to infinite God? Good to have a sponsor. Never thought about that. He said, 12 years to infinite God, Jack, is a nanosecond. It's an infinitesimal period of time. He says, quite frankly, it sounds to me like you got pretty quick service. What's your complaint? You prayed your dad would stop drinking. He stopped drinking. Hadn't thought about that. So what kind of God would you like to have, Jack? I said, I'd like to have a loving, caring, gracious, forgiving God who wants only the best for me. He said, you can have that, Jack. All you have to do is a few simple steps. Yeah, who knew? Who knew? Well, in point of fact, of course, Bob and Ken knew. They knew. They knew exactly because they had taken action on the program of recovery. I didn't know. I knew nothing. And they would come to my office and they would explain to me what they knew, and I didn't know what it was that they knew. And they knew that I didn't know. That they knew something that I didn't know. And they also knew if I knew that they knew something that I didn't know and I knew that they knew it and I didn't know it and they hadn't told me, I'd have been angry at them for knowing something that I didn't know that they knew. And so, I mean, eventually I came to know what it was that they knew that I didn't know. But until that time, I didn't know. But when I found out what it was that they knew that I didn't know, it was okay that they knew something that I didn't know, because by then I knew what it was that I didn't know. Now, if you followed any of that, you're in the right place. And if you found it the least bit confusing, that's okay. You're still in the right place. Just means you don't know. That's all. I found out in AA, you know when you know that you know, and not a moment before. And so it's okay not to know here. It's okay. I had confidence and faith that Ken and Bob knew what they were doing. They had something that I desired. I just didn't want to do what they did to get it. And Ken said, if you want something, Jack, you've never had, you're going to have to do stuff you've never done. And I explained to him, I graduated community college. I graduated University of Maryland College Park. I graduated University of Maryland School of Law with honors. And he said, we got degrees on rectal thermometers, too. You know what to do with those. I hadn't heard that before I got to AA, but I hear it around here a lot. I thought it was a little harsh at the time, but the reality of it is that you can be too smart for this program. You can be way too smart for this program. I had to just dummy up. I had to get out of the debating society. I just had to suit up and show up and do the deal. I was encouraged when I saw in the book that most of us don't like doing this stuff. Well, from my experience, I have yet to meet the person, man or woman, who enjoyed doing the stuff when we're on the third step side of the program. But on the 10th and 11th and 12th step side of the program, it's a real easy way to live. I mean, I had no idea that life could be this good. I had no idea that life could be this good. I've had a lot of really great things happen to me in recovery. Wonderful things. Incredible things. And I get the privilege of being invited to come to places like this and speak to folks like you. And I've yet to meet the man or woman who have done the steps who haven't told me that, you know, I would have sold myself short if you'd have just asked me to make a list of the things I wanted from recovery, because I've been given so much more. The year after I got blown up, my wife and I reconciled, and we've been together ever since. And our lives together have never been as good as they are today. I'm really excited about 2006, and the reason I'm excited about 2006 is because at the end of 2004, I didn't think life could get any better than it was in 2004. And by July of 2005, it had already exceeded 2004 by a big margin. And every year that I've been in AA has exceeded the previous year. And yet my mind tells me that it can't get any better than this. And yet it keeps getting better than this. Bill wrote in our literature that good is enemy of the best. And all my life I settled for good because I didn't know what the best was. And I found out that the best is available here for me if I just keep suiting up and showing up and doing stuff I don't want to do. You know, just doing the stuff that's suggested that I do. There's something wrong with my thinking. You know, and I think it's in the second chapter. It says that the problem for the alcoholic centers in the mind, that alcohol is just a symptom. And it's not about the drinking, it's about the thinking. Simply how I think is my problem. S-H-I-T. Simply how I think is my problem. We got a pamphlet here. It says, is 12 questions, is AA for you? And this is a great pamphlet. I got a little editorial change here, but here are some of the questions. Have you ever decided to stop thinking for a week or so, but only lasted for a couple of days? Do you wish people would mind their own business about your thinking and stop telling you what to do? Do you envy people who can think without getting into trouble? Have you had problems connected with thinking during the past year? Has your negative thinking cause trouble at home? Do you tell yourself that you can stop thinking anytime you want to, even though you keep thinking when you don't mean to? Have you missed days of work or school because of your thinking? Have you ever felt that your life would be better if you did not think? It's about the thinking. It's about the thinking. I have an alcoholic mind. Chapter 3 is all about not thinking. I mean, it's about thinking, but not drinking. There's no drinking in chapter 3. Jim and Fred, my most favorite guy in the big book, the Jaywalker. Man, I love that guy. Don't you just love that guy? I mean, we start talking about darting out between parked cars, I get excited. The adrenaline starts. I mean, this guy, my kind of guy. Doing the same stuff over and over again, expecting a different result. I am absolutely crazy. I am crazy. I come here, find out I got a spiritual disease. The solution is a vital spiritual experience. I think I'm a human being who's seeking a spiritual experience. I find out here I'm a spiritual being. I'm having a human experience. Who knew? I didn't know. Here's something I know. I'm here tonight as a result of prayer. I'm here as a result of prayer. I am fully satisfied that every one of you is here tonight as a result of prayer. Somebody prayed. Maybe more than one somebody prayed. But you're not here by accident. You're here as a result of prayer. I am fully satisfied that this group of human beings have never been assembled together in the history of the world. Never. And we will never be assembled again together. And we're not in this room by accident. God has brought us together. And our book says, there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Right here. Right now. If you're new here, stay here. If you've been here a while, you're not happy, joyous, and free, get together with your sponsor. You don't have a sponsor? Get a sponsor. He come in handy. This program promises me happy, joyous, and free. When I don't have that, it's not about them. It's about me. I need to be doing something that I'm not doing. Or I need to stop doing something that I am doing. But I need to talk to my sponsor about it. Because on my own, I will delude myself. I will tell myself a lie, and I will believe it to be true. I hope you all are familiar with this pamphlet, Members' Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. This group has two over here on its table. I hope that means that every member of this group has one, and all of your sponsees have one, and those are the two that are left over. But if not, order some more. I want to share something with you from the end of this pamphlet. This morning, in the churches of many of us, there was read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And hearing of the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, "Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another?" And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, "Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them." Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit, those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. A number of years ago, two men, Bob and Ken, working singularly and together, maneuvered me into Alcoholics Anonymous. Tonight, if they were here, and they were to ask me, Jack, tell us what you found, I would say to them what I say to you now. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see. The lame do walk. The lepers are cleansed. The deaf hear. The dead rise. And over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Jack. I'm an alcoholic. My date of sobriety is April the 7th, 1982. Thank you for letting me share.